For 4 years until 1938, Bechet worked as a sideman for Sissel before leaving to front his own group and pursue freelance opportunities. During the late 1930s and early 1940s, public interest in the early pioneers of jazz was on the rise, with Bechet being one of the beneficiaries of these changing attitudes. Bechet began recording in traditional jazz settings for Blue Note and other labels, as well as gigging regularly at Nick's and other New York venues. Unlike some other first-generation players, Bechet's skills had not declined by the time his music had come back into favor with jazz fans. His celebrated 1939 recording of Summertime is a case in point. Playing soprano saxophone, an instrument that in the hands of many others has an all-too-limited expressive range and a disconcerting tendency to veer out of tune, Bechet employs his full arsenal, growls, moans, plaintive calls, luminous high tones, whispered asides, even a sly quote from an opera aria. Bechet returned to Europe in May 1949 for the first time in almost 20 years to participate in a Paris jazz festival. The event was a success, and Bechet came back to France in the fall for more performances, followed by a trip to England. In a move that many later American jazz musicians would emulate, Bechet decided to settle permanently overseas. It was not a departure from his roots, he explained, since it brought him closer to Africa. In the old world, he received the adulation, financial security, and social acceptance that no black jazz musician could find in the music's native country. Performing and recording dates were abundant, as were a whole range of other artistic opportunities. These years found Bechet entertaining capacity audiences at nightclubs and concert halls, and also involved in ballet and cinema projects. Shortly before his death in 1959, he even turned littérateur, completing his autobiography, Treated Gentle, a plain-spoken work that many of his fans cherish almost as much as his legacy of recordings. The Hot Fives and Hot Sevens. Several months before leaving for New York, Armstrong married his colleague in the Oliver Band, pianist Lil Hardin. This was the second marriage for both the 23-year-old Armstrong. In his teens, he had tied the knot with Daisy Parker, from whom he soon was separated and eventually divorced, and for 26-year-old Hardin. College-educated, sophisticated, ambitious, Hardin possessed many of the qualities that Armstrong lacked. Most accounts agree that her aspirations for his career, not Armstrong's, were responsible for his break with Oliver and his decision to join Fletcher Henderson. Similarly, Hardin served as the reason for Armstrong's return to Chicago in the latter part of 1925. The stint with Henderson in New York and an ensuing tour with the band had meant an enforced separation for the pair. Several motives now drove Hardin to seek his return. Like any newlywed, she was appropriately anxious to have her husband closer at hand. In addition, she may have suspected Armstrong's dalliances, which ultimately capsized their marriage. She may have also seen opportunities for advancing Armstrong's career in Chicago, and clearly she could benefit from his presence in her own band, now set for an engagement at Chicago's Dreamland Cafe. With some misgivings, Armstrong left the Henderson Ensemble, yet took consolation in the leader's promise to rehire him if he decided to return to New York. If duties as a husband and opportunities as a sideman brought Armstrong back to Chicago, it was work as a recording star that eventually proved decisive during this period. On November 12, 1925, Armstrong entered a makeshift studio. The OK label's portable recording equipment was in Chicago only a few months out of the year, to undertake his first session as a leader. This date initiated a period of fertile music making, one that would establish Armstrong as the dominant jazz instrumentalist of his generation, perhaps of all time. Surely no other body of work in the jazz idiom has been so loved and admired as the results of these celebrated sessions, the immortal Hot Fives and Hot Sevens. In historical importance and sheer visionary grandeur, only a handful of other recordings, the Ellington Band work of the early 1940s, the Charlie Parker Savoy and Dial sessions, the Miles Davis recordings of the late 1950s come to mind, can compare with them. Certainly none can surpass them. It was a rare, felicitous instance of an artist facing a defining moment in a career, and in the process of self-discovery, also crystallizing a turning point for an entire art form. What were the elements that constituted this breakthrough in jazz performance? Armstrong's role in transforming the focus of jazz from the ensemble to the soloist has already been mentioned. But how Armstrong affected this change is the real crux of the story. It wasn't that earlier jazz players were incapable of playing solos, but compared with Armstrong, they lacked the technical resources and, even more, the creative depth to make the solo the compelling centerpiece of jazz music. For all their virtues, none of the other great players of the day, whether Bechet or Beiderbecke, Hawkins or Hines, could match Armstrong's vast range of rhythmic devices, his variegated ways of phrasing, or just the sheer inner momentum and outer logic of his melody lines. The method book Armstrong inspired during this period, called 50 Hot Choruses for the Cornet, is far from his greatest artistic achievement, but in its own way it reveals the essence of his contribution to jazz in a way that no single solo can. To compile this volume, the Melrose Publishing House recorded numerous Armstrong improvisations, had them transcribed and printed commercially, then sold the sheet music to other aspiring jazz players. The original recordings that led to this tutorial have been lost, but one need go no farther than the transcriptions to see, in page after page, measure after measure, the innovative quality of the trumpeter's work. Many of these advanced melodic ideas simply did not exist in jazz before Armstrong. The individual phrases and ways of incorporating syncopation into a jazz line were no doubt highly original at the time, but over and above these isolated gems of improvisational acumen, an ineffable wholeness to Armstrong's improvisational style must have been a revelation to other players of that era. The unassailable logic of the phrases matched their rhythmic intensity and sense of purpose. As Richard Hadlock describes it, Armstrong, regardless of tempo, always completed each phrase and carried each sustained note out to its fullest value, creating the illusion of unhurried ease, even in the most turbulent arrangement. It is one of the ironies of jazz history that this fundamental element of Armstrong's contribution is mostly obscured for many modern listeners by the very success of the trumpeter's trailblazing. To uninformed ears, these Armstrong phrases often sound commonplace today, familiar devices used by many players. It is easy to forget that the jazz world originally learned them from Armstrong. To gauge his true impact, one must go back and compare his solo work with what came before. Listen, for example, to King Oliver's stilted attempt to swing the two-bar break on his September 1924 recording of Construction Gang. Halfway through his break, Oliver loses his way, unable to marry his ambitious double-time phrasing to the ground rhythm. After a brief burst of energy, the horn line fades away abruptly, the beat lost until the piano re-enters a moment later. Compare this with any number of Armstrong hot breaks, with their rhythmic vitality and assured execution. The Hot Five, unlike most previous jazz recording units, was not a regular working band, but was put together solely for these sessions on the OK label. At first glance, the band's pretensions were modest. In terms of instrumentation and repertoire, the Hot Five was very much in the mold of earlier New Orleans ensembles. The group's lineup, which overlapped to a great degree with King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band, featured Armstrong with wife Lil Hardin Armstrong on piano, Johnny Dodds on clarinet, Kid Ory on trombone, and Johnny St. Cyr on banjo. But from the opening measures of the first take, My Heart, something different is in the air. The three horns may be playing New Orleans' counterpoint, but here Armstrong's lead line dominates the proceedings from the start in a way King Oliver would never have allowed. Armstrong once claimed that Oliver had asked him to stand far away from the recording horn during the Creole Jazz Band sessions so that his cornet would not overwhelm the ensemble. On these Hot Five sides, the opposite seems true. Armstrong is clearly positioned front and center, and, if anything, the other players sound as though they are standing several paces behind him. But this dominance of Armstrong is more than a matter of relative volume. His melody lines ripple with a newfound freedom and confidence that set them apart from the other instrumental sounds. Who dares to complain that when his bandmates solo on the ensuing take of Gut Bucket Blues, Armstrong talks over their contributions? He is the clear star here, and the other solos are featured or drowned out at his discretion. Follow-up recording dates for Louis Armstrong and his Hot Five find the bandleader even more in command. The clearest indication of this comes in the February 26th session of the following year, where Armstrong, the vocalist, takes charge. not only revealing his highly personal manner of interpreting a song, but also inventing, at least according to legend, scat singing in the process. Armstrong later described how, in the middle of recording Heebie-Jeebies, he had dropped the lyric sheet to the tune and was forced to improvise horn-like lines, built on wordless syllables, with his voice. We have good reason to be skeptical of this colorful story. Earlier examples of scat singing, as this technique came to be called, can be found. Al Jolson relied on it repeatedly on his 1911 recording of That Haunting Melody, to cite one prominent example, and Jelly Roll Morton traced it back another decade, claiming that New Orleans musicians learned scat singing from Mississippi-born Joe Sims, who was performing wordless vocals around the turn of the century. Yet after the Hot 5 recording, this practice became closely associated with Armstrong, and it remains to this day a trademark of jazz vocalists. As if this were not enough for a day's work, Armstrong also contributed a number of his finest horn solos to date at this same session. Armstrong always took delight in the use of stop-time choruses, a tried-and-true jazz device in which the band would accompany a lead player with a simple rhythmic pattern, in its most common form striking a staccato note on the first beat of each bar or every other bar, while remaining silent the rest of the time. Unless the soloist possessed enormous rhythmic ingenuity, these stop-time choruses could sound tense or even clumsy. But with a master of percussive phrasing such as Armstrong, the stop-time technique could serve as the compelling centerpiece to a performance. On two of the numbers recorded at this February 26, 1926 session, Oriental Strut and Cornet Chop Suey, Armstrong bursts forth with his finest stop-time playing to date, and on the latter he adds a swirling coda that was much imitated by his contemporaries. The use of Asian-inflected song titles to emphasize the exoticism of early jazz was not uncommon during the period, and makes the later accusations that Armstrong and others of his generation leveled at bebop, deriding it as Chinese music or jujitsu music, all the more ironic. By comparison with Armstrong's work from the following year, these solos reveal slight imperfections and moments of tentativeness, but at the time they represented the finest body of jazz improvisation yet recorded. Follow-up sessions from June and November 1926 find Armstrong displaying increasing fluency in the upper register of the horn and exerting more control over his tone and phrasing. After the November session, a period of almost 6 months passed before Armstrong's band returned to the studio, this time in an enlarged format, with the addition of Baby Dodds on drums and Pete Briggs on tuba. The new group, christened the Hot 7, boasted a more prominent, more driving rhythm section, one better able to provide a hard-swinging foundation to Armstrong's horn lines and vocals. Armstrong's new conception of jazz, with its emphasis on the soloist, demanded just such a change. His choice of instrumentation reinforced this shift and reflected his need for a more streamlined accompaniment, one that anticipated the future evolution of the rhythm section, in which piano, bass, filling a functional role similar to the tuba in early jazz by supporting the group with low-register, on-the-beat bass lines, and drums with the optional addition of guitar, worked together in providing a looser and more fluid underpinning to improvisation. During the course of several sessions in May 1927, this expanded Armstrong ensemble showed how much the leader's conception, as well as the scope of his musical ambitions, had continued to mature in the intervening months. On Wild Man Blues, the old New Orleans counterpoint is all but gone, relegated to a few brief bars at the close. Instead, the piece is given over to two long solos, one by Armstrong and another by Johnny Dodds. Dodds's work from the Hot 7 sessions reveals the great strides he made since his days with Oliver, with his bluesy solos on Willie the Weeper and Alligator Crawl standing out as especially poised. But no other horn player could outshine Armstrong at this point in the music's history. On Alligator Crawl, Armstrong follows Dodds with a masterful solo, both in terms of his rhythmic command, here the skipping syncopations with which he kicks off his solo, and technical acumen, as he moves with ease from register to register. But the crowning glory of these May sessions came in Armstrong's brilliant stop-time work on Potato Head Blues. This virtuoso improvisation set a new standard even for Armstrong. The phrasing, the tonal control, the assured sense of time, one is aware of only the slightest hint of hesitation midway through the chorus before Armstrong pushes ahead triumphantly, all contributed to making Potato Head Blues the most memorable of the Hot 7 recordings. Follow-up efforts with the Hot 5 from later in the year find Armstrong in equally fine form, contributing bravura performances of Struttin' with Some Barbecue and Hotter Than That. The Armstrong Revolution was clearly announced in these recordings, yet, strange to say, few members of the general public took notice. He continued to work as a sideman even after this extraordinary output with the Hot 5 and Hot 7. Anticipating the Beatles and Glenn Gould, Armstrong apparently felt no need to bring the music of the recording studio out in front of paying audiences, and these two bands, by any measure his most famous, never went on the road or played a nightclub engagement. Armstrong's chief paying gig during the Chicago days was as a member of violinist Carol Dickerson's ensemble. Yet the Dickerson connection was not without its benefits, if only for its fortuitous pairing of Armstrong with pianist Earl Hines, another rising star laboring in semi-obscurity as a sideman in the band. The intersection of these two careers would produce some of the most exciting jazz of the decade. The 24-year-old Hines had come to Chicago at the close of his teens. A native of Duquesne, Pennsylvania, where he was born on December 28, 1903, Earl Kenneth Hines grew up in a middle-class black family where, as he later described it, "I was just surrounded by music." Years later, critics would characterize his distinctive approach to the piano as the trumpet style, linking it to the melody lines of Armstrong. Yet the roots of this technique can perhaps be traced back to his childhood, when he began his musical studies learning trumpet from his father, who worked days as a foreman on the coal docks, and piano from his mother. But Hines's stylistic breakthrough went far beyond the use of trumpet-like lines on the piano. As part of his development, he also studied and assimilated elements of the classical repertoire, as well as a wide range of popular styles, including the blues, ragtime, and early stride piano. Hines's ability to integrate these sources of inspiration seamlessly into his own vision of keyboard performance remains a crucial part of his legacy. For, more than any other musician, Hines stands out as responsible for pushing jazz piano beyond the limiting horizontal structures of ragtime and into a more versatile and linear approach, one that continues to hold sway to this day. Hines may have lacked the harmonic sophistication of an Art Tatum or the dulcet-toned piano touch of a Teddy Wilson, but his rhythmic ingenuity, the complex interweavings of his phrases, his gamesmanship with a beat, the percussive quality of his attack, was unsurpassed. At critical moments in the course of a solo, Hines's hands would nervously fly across the keyboard, letting loose with a jagged, off-balance phrase, a flurry of notes as agitated as a swarm of honeybees forced from their hive. In the midst of this chaos, the pulse of the music would disappear. Time stood suspended. Yet almost as unexpectedly as it had erupted, this musical anarchy would suddenly subside, and the measured swing of the composition would reemerge, again solidly locked into the ground beat. Put a metronome to this apparent burst of jazz arrhythmia, and you will find that Hines has kept strict time all along. By all accounts, Hines developed his mastery of the piano at an early age. Even during his high school years, Hines led his own trio, and by the time he left for Chicago, had gigged widely in and around Pittsburgh as a piano soloist, sideman, and accompanist to vocalists. While still in Pittsburgh, he heard stride pianists Lucky Roberts and James P. Johnson, and his tenure in Chicago overlapped with Jelly Roll Morton's, as well as Teddy Weatherford's. The latter is a fascinating figure, best known for influencing Hines with his intricate two-handed keyboard style, but who deserves equal credit for his pioneering jazz advocacy in South Asia, where he performed from 1937 until his death from cholera in Calcutta in 1945. In Chicago, Hines worked primarily as a solo pianist before joining Dickerson, in time to participate in a lengthy road trip that took him to California and back. His return to Chicago coincided roughly with Armstrong's, and soon these two dominant forces in the city's jazz life were collaborating regularly, in Dickerson's band and in many other settings. For a while, the two even joined forces in operating their own dance hall, a venture that lasted only a few weeks before they decided that working as sidemen offered a higher and more predictable income stream. Following the closure of their club, Hines entered into a second musical partnership almost as fruitful as his work with Armstrong. Soon after joining New Orleans clarinetist Jimmy Noon at Chicago's Apex Club, Hines participated in a series of recordings that rank among the finest combo sides of the era. Known as the Apex Club recordings, they reflect a combination of melodic fluency and hot rhythms that was rare at the time. Noon had studied with Bechet and apprenticed with Keppard before leaving New Orleans in 1917, and later served a lengthy stint with Doc Cook. During this period, Noon developed a clarinet style distinguished by its smooth phrasing and assured execution, one that would inspire Benny Goodman and many other players associated with Chicago jazz. Hines was the perfect foil for Noon. Their crisp clarinet piano dialogues would stand unsurpassed until Benny Goodman and Teddy Wilson initiated a further revolution in small combo jazz some years later. Indeed, there was only one jazz collaboration of any sort at the time to rival the Apex Club music, and that was the one Hines embarked on in late June 1928 when he joined Armstrong in the studio for follow-up recordings of the latter's Hot Five. Armstrong leads off West End Blues with an unaccompanied introduction that has justly been praised over the years. It lasts a brief 12 seconds, but what an amazing 12 seconds. Armstrong's singular mastery of the horn is packed solidly into these few bars of improvisation. "I felt as if I had stared into the sun's eye," was Max Kaminsky's later description of his first hearing of this recording, a reaction that must have been shared by many other jazz musicians of the time. "All I could think of doing was run away and hide until the blindness left me." Yet Hines's piano solo, also only a few measures in duration, does not suffer by comparison. Midway through his chorus, his right hand accentuates a stuttering phrase in octaves, one of the trumpet-like lines so characteristic of his approach to the keyboard, that both propels the music forward and encapsulates the wide chasm between the jazz sensibility of Hines and the ragtime-based approach of virtually all of his piano contemporaries. On any short list of the defining recordings in the history of jazz, this performance holds a secure position. Weatherbird, the duet Hines recorded with Armstrong a few months later, reflects this same assured command of the new musical vocabulary being developed in Chicago at the close of the jazz age. Compare the fluid phrasing of Armstrong and Hines on this performance with the duet version of King Porter Stomp recorded 4 years earlier by Jelly Roll Morton and King Oliver. On the latter number, Morton keeps close to the oompa-oompa style of ragtime, while Oliver sounds reluctant to move too far afield from the written melody. In contrast, on Weatherbird, both Armstrong and Hines playfully employ subtle hesitations and anticipations in phrasing and engage in ambitious flights beyond the written score. If, in fact, there was a written score at the session, all with a comfortable command several steps beyond the scope of the early New Orleans pioneers. This was jazz, pure and simple, freed from both the shadow of ragtime and the dictates of dance music. Yet Armstrong, more than Hines, indeed more than any jazz player of his day, was just as comfortable working within the narrower confines of popular music. Especially in his singing, which he increasingly featured during the closing years of the decade, Armstrong captured the imagination of both jazz devotees and the general public. Musicians could marvel at his ability to swing the melody with his voice, to recraft a song with the same inventiveness that he brought to his trumpet work, but the irrepressible gusto of Armstrong's delivery and his instantly recognizable style epitomized in the raspiness that increasingly marked his singing after the early 1930s appealed to the mass market as well. He could take a dirge and make it into an ode to joy, transform the despair of "What did I do to be so black and blue" into, in the words of Ralph Ellison, "a beam of lyrical sound." As early as his March 1929 recording of "I Can't Give You Anything But Love," Armstrong was already demonstrating his sure instinct for deconstructing the vocal line, departing radically from the melody, and singing far behind the beat in a performance that ranks among the finest early ballad recordings in the jazz idiom. A few weeks later, Armstrong dazzled the audience of the Broadway musical review Hot Chocolates with his performance of "Ain't Misbehavin'." Although Armstrong merely sang from the orchestra pit between acts, the New York Times reviewer heralded this performance by an unnamed member of the band as the highlight of the show. The producers, realizing Armstrong's appeal, soon changed the script to bring him on stage to sing. This shift from the anonymity of the orchestra pit to the acclaim of the Broadway stage is, in many ways, symbolic of Armstrong's whole career during the period. 1 month after the Times review, Armstrong entered the studio to capitalize on the popularity of his work in Hot Chocolates. The approach adopted here, a trumpet melody statement, followed by an Armstrong vocal and then a trumpet solo, would become an oft-repeated recipe for success for Armstrong over the next several years. Although his vocal work takes on greater prominence in these sides, they also include some of the finest trumpet playing of Armstrong's career. One listens with admiration to Armstrong's relaxed control of the rapid tempo on Shine, the strafing double-time passages of Sweethearts on Parade, or the fluent mute work on Between the Devil and Deep Blue Sea. Armstrong's repertoire also changed during this period, with well-crafted popular songs such as Stardust and Body and Soul developing into outstanding vehicles, a far cry from the instrumental charts and novelty numbers that had been his staple in earlier years. In particular, Armstrong's vocalizing takes on an idiosyncratic splendor at this stage in his rise to fame. His Stardust veers so far from Hoagy Carmichael's original that it might as well be a new song. Yet Armstrong's alterations, simplifying and distilling the intervallic gymnastics of Carmichael's melody, underscore the music's emotional essence and serve as a deepening rather than a distraction. Armstrong's work as a vocalist would exert a tremendous influence on later jazz and popular singers. With good reason, Leslie Gorse gave the title Louise Children to her history of jazz singing. Even among his contemporaries, singers only a few years younger than Armstrong, such as Bing Crosby, Fats Waller, Jack Teagarden, and Mildred Bailey, his impact can be clearly heard. Among the next generation, it is pervasive. Armstrong's music stood out as the most dominant early influence on Billie Holiday, who carefully studied and assimilated aspects of both his singing style and trumpet work. Ella Fitzgerald was equally drawn to this same source of inspiration. Her childhood friend Annette Miller recalled her, at an early age, emulating the nuances of Armstrong's 1929 version of Ain't Misbehavin', which helped shape her sense of phrasing, rhythm, delivery, even her choice of songs. Later singers from many different orbits, from Frank Sinatra to Betty Carter, Billy Eckstine to Onita O'Day, Louis Prima to Harry Connick Jr., names that hint at the diversity of influence, to probe the depth would take a volume, were equally satellites, albeit at varying distances, each feeling the gravitational pull and drawing on the warmth and fire of Armstrong's overarching star. By the close of the 1920s, a number of other trumpeters were crafting virtuoso styles in the Armstrong mold. Jabbo Smith and Henry Red Allen, in particular, deserve recognition for their command and artistry, and their recordings serve as useful reminders that other horn players could find inspiration in Armstrong's work, while also establishing their own personal sound and conception of jazz improvisation. Although he may have lacked Armstrong's magisterial phrasing and sense of solo construction, Smith demanded the utmost respect for the speed and range of his playing, and in many ways his driving, energetic attack foreshadows the later evolution of jazz trumpet, as represented by Roy Eldridge and Dizzy Gillespie, more clearly than even Armstrong's efforts of the period. While still in his teens, Smith turned down a chance to join Ellington's band, although he made his presence felt in recording Black and Tan Fantasy with that group in 1927. In 1929, Smith made a number of sides for the Brunswick label, which include some of the most fervent trumpet playing of the period, but they sold poorly at the time. Henry Red Allen also emerged on the scene in 1929 with impressive recordings as leader and sideman on the Victor label. His playing at this stage was akin to Armstrong's in tone and structure. Hear, for example, his exultant solos on Louise Russell's Louisiana Swing, 1930, and Don Redman's Shakin' the African, 1931. But as it evolved in later years, it took on a freer, more undulating sense of time. At its best, Allen's approach to melodic construction captured a sense of spontaneity and free invention that stood out even in an art form built on these values. Such artists were formidable rivals by any measure. Armstrong thrived on the competition offered by other luminaries of the horn. He refined a crowd-pleasing bravura style during the 1930s, with many solos serving as elaborate vehicles to demonstrate his mastery, especially his skill at hitting high notes. Armstrong exhibited endless ingenuity in building up to the latter. Sometimes they cap a spirited performance. I Surrendered Here from 1931, Thanks a Million from 1935. Elsewhere, they might develop repeated descending phrases from Olympian attitudes, I'm a Ding Dong Daddy from 1930, or indulge in lazy sliding tones that may take anywhere from one beat to two bars before they arrive with a pop at the designated high tone. Shine from 1931, or let loose with repeated rhythmic stabs into the stratosphere. Swing That Music from 1936. The commercial orientation of his work became especially pronounced after the trumpeter began his long-term association with manager Joe Glazer in 1935. This relationship brought Armstrong a degree of financial security he had never yet enjoyed. Yet critical opinion about the music of this period is mixed and often contradictory. His performances and even studio dates often relied heavily on material he had mastered in earlier decades, a pattern that would continue for the rest of his career, with Armstrong eventually leaving behind more than 40 recordings of St. Louis blues and over 50 of Basin Street blues. Although these new versions occasionally repeated older renditions virtually note for note, Armstrong was capable of mounting impressive reconfigurations of his classic songs, as in his 1938 version of Struttin' with Some Barbecue, which would earn praise from trumpeters as diverse as Bobby Hackett and Maynard Ferguson. Through it all, Armstrong's showboat trumpet style, criticized by some for its formulaic qualities, lauded by others for its sheer bravura, remained a calling card of his work. Yet he also well knew the power of understatement, as on his 1940 reunion session with Sidney Bechet, an inspired pairing that anticipated Armstrong's celebrated return to a trad jazz working band 7 years later. His vocal work is perhaps less daring, albeit more stylized, on his post-1934 projects. Compared with the liberating and quasi-avant-garde efforts of the late 1920s and early 1930s. Yet no matter the setting or audience, Armstrong seemed almost incapable of singing a tune straight. Even the conventional Armstrong vocals had a way of sounding unconventional, and audiences delighted with the liberties he took. For example, at his performance for King George V of England, when he introduced a song with the unusual royal dedication, "This one's for you, Rex," adding to the piquancy, the song was, "I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you." In the final analysis, Armstrong's stiffest competition during this period was primarily with his own landmark performances from the past. And if his musical vocabulary now seemed somewhat cliched, Armstrong was hardly to blame. After all, the jazz world had stolen it from him, not the other way around. These years also saw Armstrong broaden his audience and build on his gifts as an entertainer. In 1932, during his debut tour of Europe, he both fascinated and dismayed local musicians. One delegation even demanded to examine his horn and mouthpiece, suspecting he had doctored them to facilitate his pyrotechnics. The following year, Armstrong returned, visiting England, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and Holland. And in 1934, he took an extended vacation in Paris, followed by more concerts and recordings. Soon after returning to the United States, Armstrong initiated his relationship with Glazer, whose savvy sense of career management further advanced the trumpeter's commercial prospects. For example, Armstrong's decision to work in a more traditional small combo setting in the late 1940s is often cited as a nostalgic return to the roots, but it was just as much a smart business move, driven in no small part by Glazer's appreciation of the public's renewed interest in earlier jazz styles, discussed later in this book. Above all, it was also the right artistic decision, reuniting Armstrong with Hines, Teagarden, and other sympathetic fellow travelers. Armstrong's prominent role in the 1947 Hollywood film New Orleans had paved the way for this shift and contributed to the public's growing perception of him as a historical figure, as did his celebrated February 8, 1947 Carnegie Hall concert, which featured the trumpeter in traditional small combo and more contemporary big band settings. Critics and fans expressed their preference for the former, and though Glazer and Armstrong griped about throwing 18 cats out of work, the trumpeter was soon working full-time in a downsized ensemble. In his later career, Armstrong's stage presence, repartee, and globe-roving activities as an unofficial ambassador for jazz almost overshadowed his role as a musician. Yet his playing and singing, when they took center stage, radiated an enduring, carefree ambience that contrasted greatly with the heroic exhibitions of technique from earlier decades. Armstrong could seemingly fit in effortlessly in almost any musical setting, jazz or popular, as witnessed by memorable collaborations with Ella Fitzgerald, Oscar Peterson, Duke Ellington, Bing Crosby, Johnny Cash, Barbara Streisand, Leonard Bernstein, and others. In an era in which jazz was increasingly hard-edged, some lamented the soft contours of Armstrong's music and public persona. But he was not hesitant to confront mainstream America, as when he canceled a 1957 government-sponsored tour of the Soviet Union to protest President Eisenhower's initially tepid response to the exclusion of black students from a high school in Little Rock, Arkansas. Through it all, Armstrong retained his prominence as a public figure, even more enlarged to a quasi-mythic status. As a senior citizen, he knocked the Beatles off the charts with his hugely successful recording of Hello, Dolly. The power of his artistry was further confirmed when, almost two decades after his death, his recording of What a Wonderful World became a posthumous hit on the strength of its brief appearance in a Hollywood movie. His name was not mentioned in the film, nor was his image featured. Yet audiences instantly recognized and responded to his inimitable style. The choice of both singer and song were fitting, for this figure, described by the newspapers at his death in 1971 as the most widely known American of his day, left behind an enduring and endearing artistic legacy, marked by a world embracing warmth and a universality that transcended musical genres and national boundaries. For Louis Armstrong, it was truly a wonderful world. Bix Beiderbecke and the Jazz Age. The compact geography of early jazz, as it is commonly told, is deceptively simple. Drawing its ebb and flow on a map, we seem to find ourselves staring at a sharply articulated triangle formed by three urban centers. The starting point is New Orleans, next comes Chicago, finally New York. So much of our history flows along this closed loop that we are tempted to ignore the rest of the map. Yet the Jazz Age was not confined to three cities or even 30 or 300. Probing deeper into the mythology of early jazz, we see the Mississippi River immortalized as the music's lifeline, inspiring the blues roots of the music, and eventually transporting jazz by riverboat to its second home, Chicago. The story is charming, however the map will not oblige us this time. The Mississippi skirts Chicago by a wide margin. When Louis Armstrong traveled to Chicago to join the King Oliver Creole Jazz Band, he arrived by train. And years before Armstrong's fateful trip, countless other New Orleans jazz musicians had already journeyed by train and other means, not only to Chicago, but throughout the United States and, in some instances, overseas. A number of early jazz players have left behind memoirs of these years, and their tales of nomadic adventures almost overshadow stories of the music. These various sources do, however, agree on one point. Almost from the start, jazz went on the road. These itinerant jazzmen were not alone in their missionary work for the new music. The phonograph record, even more than the musicians themselves, would play a critical role in disseminating the creative fruits of New Orleans jazz to all who cared to listen. As early as 1909, some $12 million in phonograph records and cylinders, at wholesale prices, were manufactured in the United States. Only 12 years later, sales were running at four times this level, reaching $47.8 million. This tremendous growth set the stage for a substantial increase in the recording of jazz music over the next several years. Our knowledge of jazz before the early 1920s is mostly based on hearsay, but from this point on, recordings document the intricate and variegated evolution of the music. The complex synergism between technologies of dissemination and the growth of African American music can only be hinted at here, but even when it is sketched in broad brushstrokes, one cannot ignore the telling pattern. The growth of ragtime takes place in conjunction with the spread of parlor pianos, mechanical pianos, and mass-produced sheet music. Then the blossoming of early jazz and blues occurs in tandem with a nascent market for recordings. Still ahead in our story lies the birth of the swing era, a history that took place in large measure over the airwaves. Record sales had collapsed with the Great Depression, falling almost 40% in 1930 alone. But with many listeners now turning to broadcasts, not the phonograph, for their music. Previously, the musical celebrities may have made broadcasts, but by the late 1930s, in a telling flip-flop, The broadcasts now made the celebrities, now created the audience for live music, now set the agenda for the musical tastes of a nation. The medium is the music, a truism as much today as at the dawn of jazz. Who can doubt that downloading and music files are the platform for jazz careers in the new millennium, just as 78s and radio broadcasts were in an earlier day? In truth, the entire history of jazz finds the music periodically adapting and responding to new technologies of distribution and dissemination as they emerge. It would be hard to conceive of Bix Beiderbecke becoming a jazz musician without the intervention of technology, in this case a Columbia graphophone that entered the Beiderbecke household circa 1918. Davenport, Iowa, where Leon Bix Beiderbecke was born on March 10, 1903, may have been, as often pointed out, a riverboat stop, albeit some 1,000 miles distant from New Orleans. But the span in miles was small compared to the even greater gap in culture, demographics, and attitude between the two cities. If New Orleans was a city immersed in music, Davenport was a community steeped in, what else, cornfields. By Davenport standards, the Beiderbecks were a musical family. Bix's grandfather had led the Deutsche Amerikanische Choral Society before the turn of the century, but brass dance bands, funeral parades, and blues singing played no part in their musical heritage. By almost any measure, the city and household were an unlikely setting for the education of a jazz legend. Bix's older brother Charles, who returned from service in World War I, owned this phonograph player, and a few records, including the popular jazz sides made some months earlier by the original Dixieland Jazz Band. The playing of Nick LaRocca, the standout cornetist with the ODJB, made an especially strong impression on Bix. Excited by the music, Bix announced to his befuddled parents his aspiration to learn to play jazz on the cornet. Their attempts to discourage this interest failed. Bix purchased a used horn with his allowance money and began teaching himself how to play it. At this point, he had already studied the piano. As early as 1910, the Davenport Chronicle ran an article about the 7-year-old Beiderbecke who, it claimed, can play any selection he hears on the piano entirely by ear. Soon, he was applying this same native talent with even greater fervor to his new instrument. Beiderbecke's noted ear for music would take him far, but, like his idol LaRocca and many other jazz players, Bix used it as a crutch, as a way of avoiding the rigors of formal study. His early piano lessons were deemed, despite the youngster's talent, a failure. Beiderbecke never learned to read music fluently, since it was much easier for him to play the lesson by ear. The same mixture of precociousness and studied nonchalance marked his approach to the cornet. Not only did his reading skills fail to improve on the new instrument, but, in his attempt to teach himself, Bix adopted an unusual dry embouchure and fell into a habit of using unconventional fingerings, which he stuck with even after the proper method was pointed out to him. No doubt a characteristic streak of obstinacy underlay this chronic disregard of the tried and true. Years later, Beiderbecke was equally stubborn in continuing to play the cornet long after most of his contemporaries had switched to the trumpet. In so many aspects of his life, Beiderbecke was determined to do things his way or not at all. Wary of their child's growing interest in jazz music, perhaps rightly given Beiderbecke's later fatal adoption of all the worst habits of the jazz lifestyle, Bix's parents decided that firm action was required. The youngster was enrolled in a boarding school where, they hoped, he would pick up a solid education and greater self-discipline. In retrospect, the decision was fated for failure from the start, for their chosen school, Lake Forest Academy, was situated only a short train ride away from Chicago, then rapidly becoming the jazz capital of the world. The worst that Bix could have done in Davenport paled in comparison to the potential for trouble in this new setting. Within a short time of his arrival at the academy, Bix was regularly violating the strict curfew regulations. Their disregard would eventually lead to his dismissal, and haunting the various night spots of Chicago and its environs. At first, Bix went on these midnight expeditions simply to listen and, occasionally, to sit in with various bands. But, as word of his prowess on the cornet spread, he began performing with his own group, composed of a mix of Lake Forest Academy co-conspirators and ringers from Chicago. After his expulsion from Lake Forest Academy, Bix must have recognized that his passport to a career would never be reached through an Ivy League degree, although Bix would hatch occasional plans to return to his studies, but by means of his cornet and ear for music. Beiderbecke's first major band, the Wolverines, brought together a group of like-minded instrumentalists. These all but unknown young jazz devotees took their inspiration primarily from the performances of the New Orleans Rhythm Kings. During that band's engagement at Friar's Inn, members of Bix's circle were frequently in attendance, listening, learning, sometimes sitting in with a group. A chance to put this education into practice came in October 1923, when clarinetist Jimmy Hartwell succeeded in obtaining regular employment for the Wolverines at the Stockton Club, located 17 miles north of Cincinnati. Performances here and at other venues in the area gave the musicians ample opportunity to refine their craft and develop an enthusiastic local following. But greater fame would have been inconceivable this far distant from the major music capitals of America had not the Wolverine secured an opportunity to spend a day recording at the Jeanette Recording Studio in Richmond, Indiana, some 125 miles away from Cincinnati. This was a turning point, not only in documenting the band's progress to date, but also in reinforcing the confidence of this group of novices to the music industry. No amount of words could adequately describe the excitement and utter amazement of that first recording, played back to us for correction of positions around the recording horns, recalled George Johnson, tenorist with the group. I doubt if any of us realized until that moment how different in style and how dissimilar in effect our results were from the music of the Friars Band that had thrilled us all so barely months before. Beiderbecke's debut recordings with the Wolverines only hint at the potential of the young cornetist. His solos, for all their poise, are melodically simple by comparison with the work he would create over the next several years. Evidence of Beiderbecke's sensitivity to altered tones is apparent. Hear his use of flatted fifths and ninths in his work on Riverboat Shuffle, but one also notes the relaxed delivery so characteristic of Bix's phrasing. Above all, the expressive, at times haunting tone of Beiderbecke's cornet demands our attention. Bix may not have mastered the dirty, rough-edged sound of a King Oliver, a style vastly influential at this stage in the history of jazz, nor do his solos burst forth with the unbridled energy that Armstrong would soon bring to the music, but they sing in a way that was unique in the context of mid-1920s jazz. Not so much played, they sound as though lofted gently from the bell of the horn, left to float in a stream of warm air. Eddie Condon, a collaborator of Beiderbecke's, also sensed an invitation in Bix's sound, like a girl saying yes, was his oft-quoted appraisal of his initial encounter with it. For the first time I realized that music isn't all the same, that some people play so differently from others that it becomes an entirely new set of sounds. Hoagie Carmichael, grabbing for an even odder illusion, saw Bix's music affecting him in a different way. Can't tell you how, like licorice you have to eat some. Bix's breaks were not as wild as Armstrong's, but they were hot, and he selected each note with musical care. He showed me that jazz could be musical and beautiful, as well as hot. To Mez Mezro, Beiderbecke's tone was pickled in alcohol. I have never heard a tone like he got before or since. He played mostly open horn, every note full, big, rich, and round, standing out like a pearl, loud but never irritating or jangling, with a powerful drive that few white musicians had in those days. Louis Armstrong, recalling a Beiderbecke performance in Chicago in the mid-1920s, said simply, "I'm telling you, those pretty notes went right through me." A pearl or a girl? Liquor or licorice? These poetic comparisons may strike some listeners today as being at odds with the body of work that Beiderbecke left behind. Studio technology of the 1920s did not serve the cornetist well. Records never quite reproduced his sound, Pee-wee Russell has attested, with many others concurring in the judgment. Acoustic recordings, with their use of a single horn to capture music and translate it mechanically into grooves on a wax disc, present modern-day fans, weaned on the crystal clarity of digital technology, with a flattened, one-dimensional sound. Like shadows in Plato's cave, these artifacts from audio's earliest days are merely indicative, not truly representative, of the absent originals. And electric recordings, launched in the mid-1920s, sound only marginally better. This innovation was slow in demonstrating its advantages, so much so that, at the time, many listeners lamented its introduction as a step backward. For a solo performance, such as a classical piano piece, or for a vocal number in which the singer was situated front and center, the early recording devices proved adequate, if just barely, in conveying the essence of live music. But for ensemble music, such as New Orleans and Chicago-style jazz, the clarity of the individual instruments was greatly compromised. Although the rhythm, melody, and harmony were there for the careful listener to hear, or even to notate, the subtleties of tone are all but lost. For an artist like Beiderbecke, for whom quality and texture of sound were almost as important as the actual notes played, the resulting records are little more than a simulacrum of the actual performance. But like sailors peering into murky waters, we find that, though we may not be able to measure Beiderbecke's genius in precise fathoms, even this indistinct ebb and flow gives little doubt that it is ever so deep and broad. Between the first and second 1924 sessions for the Wolverines, Beiderbecke celebrated his 21st birthday. Strange to say, though Bix was barely out of his teens, the cornetist was poised to enter the middle period of his career. Indeed, the chronology of this celebrated musician is all too compact. His entire recorded oeuvre would span less than 7 years, with even this abbreviated history broken down into several distinct stages. By the time of Bix's final recordings with the Wolverines in late 1924, the band had already traveled to New York at almost the same time that Armstrong had moved there to join Henderson. Before the close of the year, Beiderbecke had left the band to embark on a fertile period of freelancing and experimentation. These halcyon days, which lasted from the middle of the decade to the stock market crash of 1929, witnessed much of Beiderbecke's greatest work. But this period also encompassed an exceptional flourishing of improvised music on a much wider scale, one that music historians have come to designate simply as Chicago jazz. Beiderbecke's contributions, as great as they are, were just one facet of this new sound, this new style. Like the New Orleans tradition that preceded it and the swing-era offerings that followed it, Chicago jazz was not just the music of a time and place, but also a timeless style of performance, and, for its exponents, very much a way of life, one that continues to reverberate to this day in the work of countless Dixieland and traditional jazz bands around the world. For many listeners, the Chicago style remains nothing less than the quintessential sound of jazz. Chicago and New York. As with much of early jazz, the story of the Chicago School has taken on a larger-than-life quality with the passage of time. Facts and falsehoods, myths and memories have coalesced into a pseudo-history, a romanticized account of glory days with all the authenticity of a maudlin Hollywood script. Here we find gangsters and speakeasies, riverboats and flashy attire, all bundled together in a colorful tapestry. The truth is somewhat more complicated and often less glamorous. True, jazz traveled to Chicago, albeit by land, not river, at an early stage in its development. But it also journeyed to many other parts of the country through the missionary efforts of King Oliver, Freddie Keppard and the original Creole Orchestra, Jelly Roll Morton, and others. The Chicago night spots were often makeshift rather than opulent. Lincoln Gardens, the celebrated home base for King Oliver, had chicken wire on the ceiling, and the famous Dreamland Ballroom doubled as a roller rink. And yes, booze and criminal elements could be found where the music played, but this connection neither started in the Windy City nor ended there. Further, the association of the so-called Chicago style of music with its leading figure, Bix Beiderbecke, is also rather puzzling. Bix played little in Chicago. If anything, his residencies in New York stand out as the decisive interludes in his musical career. Then again, when dealing with the topsy-turvy subject of jazz geography, be prepared for the strangest contradictions. Just as much of the history of New Orleans jazz took place in Chicago, so did the sounds of Chicago jazz eventually find their most hospitable home in New York. The further stereotype that associates early Chicago jazz almost solely with white musicians is equally off mark. As we have already seen, the finest African-American musicians from New Orleans and elsewhere, Armstrong, Hines, Morton, Oliver, Noon, Dodds, had already gravitated to Chicago by the mid-1920s. William Howland Kenney, in his study of the biographies of 55 black musicians associated with Chicago jazz during the 1920s, determined that nearly half came from New Orleans, and a similar percentage arrived during or just following World War I. Black jazz, white jazz, hot jazz, sweet jazz, New Orleans jazz, Dixieland jazz, no matter what you call it or how you define it, it all became part of Chicago jazz during these formative years. The similarities between the music of the white Chicagoans and their New Orleans models have often been noted, frequently by the Chicagoans themselves. But close listening reveals subtle gradations of difference. A certain restless energy begins to reverberate in the music. Counterpoint lines no longer weave together, as in the earlier New Orleans style, but often battle for supremacy. The specific roles filled by the New Orleans front line are modified. The tailgate trombone tradition, with its use of portamentos or slurs to link harmony notes, is less evident among the Chicago players. And at times, the trombone is totally absent, replaced by the tenor sax, which takes on a more linear and overtly melodic role. The Chicago clarinetists, following the lead of Rapallo, move away from the figured arpeggios of New Orleans, instead adopting mannerisms that, in New Orleans style, were more typical of cornetists. Here, for instance, Frank Teschemacher's pungent and at times raspy lines, a cheeky attitude on the horn that would influence Benny Goodman and other swing-era players. The Chicago horns often join together for brief written introductions and interludes, a technique closer to the big band idiom than to the New Orleans tradition. A host of stylistic devices, with some precedent in New Orleans jazz, also figure as signposts of the white Chicagoans. The flare-up, a polyphonic outburst, at its simplest, merely a held chord, initiated by a drum break, placed for best effect at the close of the first chorus. The explosion, a forerunner of the bop drummer's bomb, which aimed to light a fire under the soloist or ensemble by accentuating the backbeat in the measure before the start of a new 8-bar section. The shuffle rhythm, which conveyed the feel of double time, often used to add variety to the bridge of a 32-bar song form. And the break, the time-honored formula honed in New Orleans, a 2 or 4-bar interlude during which the band held back while the soloist stepped forward to proclaim a hot phrase. But we should not neglect the influence of the various non-jazz musical traditions that the multi-ethnic Chicagoans, as well as the later members of the New York school, brought with them to their jazz-making. At times, their minor key melodies conveyed more than a hint of klezmer, as for instance on Goodman's early leader sides, That's a Plenty and Clarinetitis. Teschemacher also showed the influence of his early violin training, which occasionally transmits the ambience of a European street fiddler to his clarinet lines. And who can listen to the string music of Giovannuti and Eddie Lang without hearing echoes of the Italian lyric tradition? A fascination with contemporary classical music and other experimental currents is also evident among this generation of jazzmen, inspiring their adoption of esoteric harmonies and rhythms. Beiderbecke is the most prominent example, but also note Tesh's use of 6-4 in the intro to Liza. These tributaries of inspiration flowed together in broadening the vocabulary of jazz during the late 1920s and early 1930s. The music was still a pay-on to the New Orleans sound, but it also pointed forward to the later swing-era preferences for tighter arrangements, greater expressive range and variety, and a more pronounced separation of solo and ensemble textures. Yet it is important to recognize that economic as well as aesthetic considerations contributed to the evolution of this music. Musicians of all styles, all races, all instruments came to Chicago not because of an allegiance to a certain idiom of jazz, but rather to tap the opportunities to perform and earn a livelihood that the setting offered. Sidemen in Chicago bands could earn $40 per week or more during the years following World War I, a far cry from the $1.50 to $2.50 per engagement a New Orleans player might have commanded during that era. In response, musicians from all regions converged on the city, a process that we have already described with regard to the World's Columbian Exposition, which drew Scott Joplin and many other rag pianists to Chicago in 1893. There were, of course, many outstanding jazz players from this period who were born or raised in Chicago. Benny Goodman, Gene Krupa, Muggsy Spanier, and others. Just as many came from the suburbs, or, like Beiderbecke, from other parts of the Midwest. But these players remained in Chicago not due to any loyalty to their native soil, but because of the vibrant local jazz scene and the financial security it represented. As previously mentioned, the conventions of New Orleans jazz began to change in this new setting, but even in this regard, economic factors may have exercised a predominant influence. Perhaps the most obvious shift came in the repertoire of the local jazz bands. During the decade of the 1920s, popular songs and 32-bar forms were increasingly used by Chicago jazz musicians, while blues and multi-theme ragtime structures, so central to the New Orleans tradition, became less common. This move does not seem to have been driven by aesthetic considerations. It is hardly mentioned by the players themselves in the many memoirs and interviews from the period, but came about gradually as a response to the changing demands of audiences. The blues recording craze of the early 1920s had already